I looked at it. His lordship was perfectly right. The 12 puzzled and honest citizens picked off the street at random were conspicuous by their absence. Juries are not welcome in the Chancery Division. This was one of the occasions, strange to Rumpole, of a trial by judge alone. It is, therefore, Mr. Rumpole, not an occasion for emotional appeals. The judge continued his lesson. Perhaps it would be more useful if you gave me some relevant dates and a comparison of the two wills. Certainly, my lord, I said, always anxious to oblige. By his true last will of the 1st of March, 1974, the late colonel recognized the care of a devoted matron.
Just the facts, Mr. Rumpole.
Just give me the plain facts, snapped the old spoilsport. And the plain fact is, under the previous will of the 15th of February, 1970, the Percival Allards had managed to scoop the pool. Scoop the pool was, it seemed, not a phrase or saying in current use in the Chancery Division.
You mean, I suppose, the judge corrected me, that Mr. Percival Allard, together with his wife and son, were the sole beneficiaries of the deceased's residuary estate.
Somehow I managed to finish giving the judge the brief facts of the case without open warfare breaking out. But the atmosphere was about as convivial as a gathering of teetotal undertakers. I then called Matron to give evidence. She filled the witness box with authority. She was dressed in respectable and respectful black. She gave her answers in ringing and resonant tones, and yet I could tell that the judge didn't like her. As she gave her touching description of her devoted care of the late colonel, and her harrowing account of the Percival Allards' neglect of their relative, Mr. Justice Venables looked upon Matron as though she was a person who had come to his court for one reason only, money. Well, it was a charge which might with equal justice be levelled against me, and Guthrie Featherstone, and even, let it be said, the learned judge. Finally, Matron, I asked the last question, with a solemnity which would have deeply moved the jury, if there had been a jury. What did you think of the deceased?
He had his little ways, of course, but he was always a perfect gentleman.
She looked at the judge. He averted his eye. What do you call each other? I asked.
It was always Matron and Colonel Allard, but you were friends. It was always on a proper basis, Mr. Rumpole. I don't know what you're suggesting.
Miss Beasley gave me an old-fashioned look, whereat Featherstone, seeing a rift in our ranks, levered himself to his hind legs and addressed a sympathetic judge. I hope my learned friend isn't suggesting anything by way of a leading question.
Certainly not, my lord.
And I went on before his lordship had time to answer. Miss Beasley, during the years that Colonel Allard was with you, did Mr. Percival Allard visit him at all?
I think he came over once or twice in the first couple of weeks. Once he took the Colonel for a run on the downs, I think, and tea out.
Featherstone had the grace to subside, and my questioning continued. But after that...
No, he never came at all. And his family, his wife Marcia, and the young Nijinsky.
Well, what, Mr. Rumpole? Mr. Justice Venables was not amused. Master Peter Allard, my lord, a lad with terpsichorean tastes.
Oh, no, I never saw them at all.
Yes, thank you. Just wait there a moment, will you, Miss Beasley? I subsided. Then Guthrie Featherstone rose. I had no particular worries. The middle-of-the-road MP was merely a middle-of-the-road cross-examiner.
Miss Beasley, you say that Colonel Allard had his little ways.
Guthrie began in a voice like hair oil poured on velvet.
He did, yes.
Matron faced the old darling with confidence.
Is Miss Mary Waterhouse one of your nurses?
She was whether my nurse is here. The name brought a small sign of disapproval from the Generalissimo of Sunnyside. Did the Colonel take boiled eggs for breakfast? Fellison asked what I thought at the time was not much of a question.
On Sundays?
Otherwise he had bacon and sausage. And did the Colonel once fling his boiled eggs at Nurse Waterhouse and instruct her, and I quote, to sit on the bloody things and hatch them out? I let out a small guffaw, in which the judge didn't join. I even began to warm to the memory of Colonel Allard.
He may have done,
Matron conceded. The Colonel disliked hard-boiled eggs. Featherston, bless his timid old heart, seemed to be making a fair deduction.
He disliked a lot of things, Mr. Featherston, including young boys who indulged in ballet lessons.
Matron tried to snicker crafty one through the slips. That, of course, fell foul of the judge immediately.
Just answer the questions, Miss Beasley. Try not to score points off the other side.
Venables, Jay, warned her. Again, I got the strong impression that his lordship hadn't exactly warmed to matey.
Did he also dislike slices of toast which were more than exactly 4 inches long?
The Colonel liked things just so, yes, Miss Beasley admitted.
And did he measure his toast with a slide rule each morning to make sure it was the correct length?
Seems a perfectly reasonable thing to do, I said to Mr. Pontefract, in what I hoped was an audible mutter.
Did you say something, Mr. Rumpole?
The judge inquired coldly. I heaved myself to my feet.
I just wondered, my lord, does the fact that a man measures his toast mean that he's not entitled to dispose of his property exactly as he likes? At this, the old sweetheart on the bench decided to do his best to polish up my manners. Mr. Rumpole, he said, your turn will come later. Mr. Guthrie Featherston is cross-examining. In the Chancery Division, we consider it improper to interrupt a cross-examination unless there's a good reason to do so.
Of course, I bowed low and said, if your lordship please. As a rank outsider, I am, of course, delighted to get your lordship's instructions on the mysteries of the Chancery Division. I suppose old Venables thought that down the Old Bailey we interrupted opponents by winking at the jury and singing sea shanties. It was then my turn to subside and let Featherston continue.
Let me ask you something else, Matron. Colonel Allard had fought, had he not, at the Battle of Anzio. That was where he won his military cross,
said Miss Beasley with some understandable pride in the distinction of her late patient.
Yes, of course.
Very commendable. That was a tribute, of course, coming from Featherston. I seem to remember that he did his military service in the Soldiers' Divorce Division.
Then Featherston asked another question.
Matron, he purred with his usual charm,
did Colonel Allard tell you that he had frequently discussed the Battle of Anzio with the Prime Minister, the late Sir Winston Churchill?
I know that Sir Winston was always interested in Colonel Allard's view of the war, yes. Miss Beasley sounded proud, and even the judge looked impressed.
And that he had also discussed it with Field Marshal Lord Montgomery of Alamein?
Colonel Allard called him Bernard.
And with the then Soviet leader, Mr. Stalin? Did Colonel Allard call him Joseph?
Oh, dear. I sighed to myself. Things were becoming grim when Featherston tried to make a funny.
No. He always called him Mr. Stalin.
Miss Beasley answered primly.
Very respectful, if I may say so.
Featherston gave the judge a chummy little smile, and then turned back straight-faced to the witness.
You know, he told Nurse Waterhouse one morning last October that he had been talking to Sir Winston, Lord Montgomery, and Mr. Stalin the evening before.
Does that surprise you?
I had the awful feeling that Featherstone had struck gold. There was a sudden silence in court as Pontefract and I held our breath, waiting for Matron's answer. When it came, it was a simple no.
You say it doesn't surprise you, Miss Beasley?
Venables J. leant forward, frowning unpleasantly. Not in the least, my lord. The answer was positively serene. I wanted to tell the judge not to interrupt the cross-examination. After all, we didn't do that sort of thing in the Chancery Division. But Featherstone, as he went on, was doing quite well even without a little help from the judge.
Nurse Waterhouse will also say that Colonel Allard told her that he had been chatting to Alexander the Great, the Emperor Napoleon, and the late Duke of Marlborough, my opponent suggested.
Well, of course he would, you know. Miss Beasley smiled back at him.
He would say that because he was suffering from mental instability?
Of course not. The witness was outraged. The Colonel had as much mental stability as you or I, Mr. Featherstone.
Speak for yourself, Miss Beasley.
Oh, very funny, Featherstone, I thought. What a talent. You ought to go on the halls.
Why did you say that the Colonel would speak to those gentlemen?
Featherstone asked for clarification.
Because they were all keenly interested in his subject, Miss Beasley explained, as though it were a rather backward two-year-old.
Which was?
Military matters.
Oh, military matters, yes, of course.
Featherstone paused, and then asked politely, but all the names I've mentioned, Churchill and Montgomery, Marlborough and Napoleon, Stalin and Alexander the Great, they're all dead, aren't they, Matron?
Yes, indeed. But that wouldn't have worried the Colonel. She gave the opposition leader a patient smile. Colonel Allard was most sympathetic to people who were ill. Being dead wouldn't have put him off at all.
But did the Colonel think he could talk to those deceased gentlemen?
Oh, yes. Of course he could.
As Pontefract and I began to see the last will of Colonel Allard going up in smoke, the judge said,
do you really believe that, Miss Beasley?
I must say the answer that Matron gave was not particularly helpful. She merely looked at the judge with some pity and said, you could talk to the Emperor Napoleon, my lord, if you were a believer.
A believer, Miss Beasley?
No doubt a church warden and chairman of the parish council, the judge looked more than a little irked by her reply.
A believer in communication with the other side.
At least she had the grace to explain.
And both you and Colonel Allard were believers.
Featherstone led her gently on down the primrose path to disaster.
Oh, yes, we had that much in common.
Can you communicate with the late Joseph Stalin, Miss Beasley?
That was a shot in the dark by Featherstone, but it scored a bullseye.
Of course I could, Miss Beasley said modestly, but let's just say I wouldn't care to.
Perhaps not. But can you communicate, for instance, with the late Colonel Allard?
Yes, indeed. She had no doubt about that.
When did you last do so, Miss Beasley?
Said the judge, following his leader, Featherstone, like a bloodhound.
Yesterday evening, my lord.
Oh, dear. Oh, my ears and whiskers, I groaned to myself as the psychic matron blundered on, addressing her remarks to the learned judge.
And I may say that the colonel is very distressed about this case, my lord, very distressed indeed. In fact, he thinks it's a disgraceful thing to argue about it when he'd made his will perfectly clear and left it in his uniform box. I wouldn't like to tell you, my lord, the things that the colonel had to say about his brother Percy.
I think you'd better not, Miss Beasley.
Featherstone brought her smoothly to a halt. That would be hearsay evidence. We shall have to wait and see whether my learned friend Mr. Rumpole calls the deceased gentleman as a witness. Oh, she'd various, I told myself bitterly. Guthrie Featherstone's been most hilarious. My God, he's working well today. We, that is Matron, Mr. Pontefract and self, had luncheon in the crypt under the law courts, a sepulchral hall where, it seemed, very old Place and Chips come to die. Miss Beasley's legal team were not in an optimistic mood. The judge doesn't like you all that much, I'm afraid, Miss Beasley. I thought it best to break the news to her gently. Never mind, Mr. Rumpole. The feeling's entirely mutual. She looked, all things considered, ridiculously cheerful. If you take my advice, Miss Beasley, you should go for a settlement. Pontefract was trying to talk some sense into her. Save what you can from the wreckage. You see, once you had to admit that the late colonel used to talk to the Emperor Napoleon. What's wrong with talking to the Emperor Napoleon? Miss Beasley frowned. He can be quite charming when he puts his mind to it. I don't think the judge is likely to accept that, I warned her. You'd talk to the Emperor Napoleon, I'm sure, if he came across to you. Miss Beasley didn't seem to be getting the drift of my argument. I put it more bluntly. Mr. Pontefract is right. The time has come to chuck in the towel on the best terms we can manage. You mean surrender? She looked at us both displeased. Well, on terms, Miss Beasley. Mr. Pontefract tried to soften the blow, but an answer came like the bugle call which set off the charge of the Light Brigade. Colonel Allard will never surrender, she trumpeted. Anyway, you haven't cross-examined that wretched Percy Allard yet. The Colonel says Mr. Rumpole's a great cross-examiner. That's very kind of him. I tried to sound modest. He says he'll never forget reading your cross-examination about the bloodstains in the Penge bungalow murders. He read every word of it in the Sunday paper. My dear lady, that was 35 years ago. Anyway, I had a jury to play on in that case, and at my best for the jury. This is a cold-blooded trial in the Chancery Division by judge alone, and that judge is distinctly unfriendly. The Colonel says Mr. Rumpole will hit my brother Percy for six. She repeated the words as if they were holy writ. Tell the Colonel, I asked her, that Rumpole isn't at his best without a jury. A trial without jury is like an operation without anaesthetic, or a luncheon without a glass of wine. Shall we drown this old fish, Pontefract, my old darling, I suggested, in a sea of cooking claret? What I can't accept about spiritualism is the idea of millions of dead people, there must be standing room only in the other side, kept hanging about just waiting to be sent for by some old girl with a Ouija board in a Brighton boarding house, or a couple of table tappers in Tring, for the sake of some inane conversation about the blueness of the infinite. I mean, at least when you're dead, you'd surely be spared such tedious social occasions. Nevertheless, there was Colonel Allard, apparently at matey's beck and call, ready and willing to cross the Great Divide and drop in on her at the turn of a card or the shiver of a wine glass. I was expressing some of these thoughts to Hilda in a feverish sort of way that evening, as I hugged my dressing gown round me and downed medicinal claret by the electric fire in Froxbury Court. Really, Rumpole said she, don't be so morbid. I can smell corruption. I sneezed loudly. The angel of death is brushing me with his wings. Rumpole, Dr. McClintock has told you it's only a cold. Dr. McClintock gave me a warning on the subject of death. At which there was a ring at the door, and Hilda said, oh, good heavens, that's never the front doorbell. With a good deal of clucking and tucking, Hilda went out to the hall, and eventually ushered Miss Rosemary Beasley, who appeared to be carrying some kind of plastic hold-all, into the presence of the sick. When she asked me how I was, I told her I was dying. Well, don't die yet, Mr. Rumprell. You've got our case to win. Don't you think I could conduct it perfectly well from beyond the grave? I asked Matron. Now you're teasing me. Your husband is the most terrible tease, she told a puzzled Hilda. Listen to this, Mr. Rumprell. The Colonel says that he has an urgent message for you. He'll deliver it here tonight, so I've brought the board. The what? The planchette, of course. To my dismay, Matron then produced from her black plastic hold-all a small heart-shaped board on casters which she plonked onto our dining table. There was paper fixed on the board, and Miss Beasley held a pencil poised over it, and the board then moved in a curious fashion, causing writing to appear on the paper. It looked illegible to me, but Miss Beasley deciphered some rather cheeky communications from a late and no doubt unlamented Red Indian chief, who finally agreed to fetch Colonel Allard to the planchette. Tearing himself away from the Emperor Napoleon, the Colonel issued his orders for the day, emerging in Miss Beasley's already somewhat masculine voice as she read the scribbles on the board. The Colonel says, "Hello there, Rumpo," Miss Beasley informed us. "Well, answer him, Rumpo, be polite." Hilda appeared enchanted with the whole ludicrous performance. "Oh, hello there, Colonel." I felt an idiot as I said it. "It's very blue here, Rumpole, and I'm very happy." Miss Beasley came through as the late holder of the military cross. "Oh, good. What else could I say?" "Tomorrow you will cross-examine my brother Percival." "Well, I hope so. I'm not feeling..." Here I sneezed again. "Quite up to snuff." "Brace up, Rumpole, no malingering. Tomorrow you will cross-examine my brother in court." Miss Beasley relayed Colonel Allard's instructions. "Yes, Colonel. Aye, aye, sir." "Ask him what we said to each other when he visited me in the nursing home and he drove me up to the Downs. Ask him what the conversation was when we had cream tea together at the Bidewee tea rooms. Go on, Rumpole. Ask Percy that." Colonel Allard may have been a very gallant officer and an inspired leader of men. I doubted if he was a real expert in the art of cross-examination. "Is it a good question?" I asked the deceased, doubtfully. "Percy won't like it, just as Jerry didn't like cold steel. Percy will run a mile from that question," Miss Beasley croaked. "Colonel, I make it a rule to decide on my own cross-examination. I wanted to make the position clear, but the answer came back almost in a parade ground bellow. Ask that question, Rumpole. It's an order." I'll consider it. I suppose it doesn't do to hurt the feelings of the dead. Do so. Oh, and see you over here sometime." At which it seemed the consultation was over, and Colonel Allard returned to some celestial bowling green to while away eternity. It was perfectly ridiculous, of course. I knew quite well that the deceased colonel wasn't manipulating the planchette. But as for asking his question, I could tell by the judge's attitude next morning that we had absolutely nothing to lose. Percival Allard was not, I thought, a particularly attractive-looking customer. The successful manufacturer of kitchen utensils had run to fat. He had a bristling little ginger moustache and small flickering eyes that seemed to be looking round the court for ways of escape. Featherstone led him smoothly through his evidence in chief, and then I rose to cross-examine. The learned judge put a damper on my first question. "I'm really wondering," he said, "how much longer this estate is going to be put to the expense of this apparently hopeless litigation." "Not long, my lord," I said with a confidence I didn't feel, "after I have cross-examined this witness." And I turned to the witness box. Mr. Percival Allard, were you on good terms with your brother before he went into the nursing home?
Extremely good terms. We saw each other regularly, and he always sent my boy Peter a postal order for Christmas and birthdays.
That was before the Colonel started talking to the dead, the judge asked in a way unfriendly to Rumpole.
Yes, my lord.
Percy looked gratefully at my lord.
Before he became, shall we say, eccentric in the extreme, the judge went on.
Yes, my lord.
Very well.
Venables J. now seemed to have worn himself out.
Carry on if you must, Mr. Rumpole.
2 weeks after he went into the nursing home, you took him for a drive on the downs. Rumpole carried on.
I did, yes.
Percy's nervousness seemed to have returned, although I couldn't imagine why the memory of tea on the downs posed any sort of threat to him.
You were then on good terms?
Yes.
You shared tea, scones and clotted cream at the Bideawee Cafe?
It was strange, the effect on the witness of this innocent question. He took out a silk handkerchief, wiped his forehead, and had to force himself to answer.
Yes, we did.
And talked?
We talked, yes.
Percy answered so quietly that the judge was constrained to tell him to speak up. And after that conversation, you and your brother never met or spoke to each other again.
There was a long pause.
Had I stumbled, guided by a dead hand on some vital piece of evidence? I couldn't believe it.
No. We never did.
And he made a will, cutting out your family and leaving all his considerable property to my client, Miss Beasley.
He made an alleged will, Mr. Rumpole.
The judge was at pains to remind me. I bowed respectfully and said, if that's what you call it in the Chancery Division, yes, my lord. What I want to ask you, Mr. Percival Allard, is simply this. What did you and your brother say to each other at the Bideawee Cafe? Now the pause seemed endless. Percy looked at Featherstone and got no help. He looked at his wife and his ballet-dancing son. He looked vainly at the doors and the windows. And finally his desperate gaze fell on the learned judge.
My lord, must I answer that question?
He said,
Mr. Rumpole, do you press the question?
His lordship asked me with distaste.
My lord, I do. For some reason, I was on to a good thing, and I wasn't letting it go.
Then it is relevant, and you must answer it, Mr. Allard.
At least the judge knew his business.
My lord,
Percival Allard stammered. He was clearly extremely distressed. So distressed that the judge had time to look at the clock and relieve the witness's agony for an hour.
I see the time, he said. You may give us your answer after luncheon, Mr. Percival Allard. Shall we say 2 o'clock?
We all rose obediently to our hind legs, with Rumpole muttering, bloody Chancery judges, let old Percy off the hook. Miss Beasley vanished somewhere at lunchtime. And when I had returned from a rather unhappy encounter with the place in the crypt, I found Guthrie Featherstone waiting for me outside the court. He offered me a cigarette, which I refused, and he lit my small cigar with a gold lighter.
Horace, he said, we've always got on pretty well at the bar.
Have we, Guthrie?
My client has come to a rather agonizing decision.
You mean he's going to answer my question?
It's not that, exactly. You see, Horace, we're chucking in the sponge. Our hands are up. We surrender. Matron can have her precious will. We offer no further evidence.
You could have knocked me down with a chancery brief. But I tried to sound nonchalant.
Oh, really, Featherstone, I said, that's very satisfactory.
It was also somewhat incredible. But Guthrie, it became clear, had other matters on his mind.
I say, Rumble, a fellow must be certain of his fee. You'll let me have my costs out of the estate, won't you?
I suppose so, I warned him. I'd better just check.
With your client?
Not only with her, I said, with the deceased. I mean, it's his money, isn't it? And I left him thinking, no doubt, that old Horace Rumpole had completely lost his marbles. When Matron came into view, I put the proposition to her. I told her that the Percival Allards would give her all the boodle, only provided that Guthrie and their other lawyers got their costs out of the estate. She and the dear departed must have had a convivial lunch together. Agreement was reached, and the deal was on. With about as much joy and enthusiasm as King John might have shown when signing Magna Carta, Mr. Justice Venables pronounced, in the absence of further argument, for the will of the 1st of March 1974 benefiting Miss Beasley, and against the earlier will which favoured the Percival Allards. All parties were allowed their costs out of the estate. When we came out of court, Matron seized my hand in a muscular grasp. "Thanks most awfully, Mr. Rumpole," she said. "The Colonel knew you'd pull it off and hit number six. Miss Beasley, may I call you Matey? Please. What's the truth of it? What did the brothers say to each other over the scones and Darjeeling?" There was a pause. And then Miss Beasley said, with a small, secret smile, "How would I know that, Mr. Rumpole? Only the Colonel and his brother know that." However, I was not to be left in total ignorance of the truth of in the estate of Colonel Allard deceased. After we had taken off our robes, Guthrie Featherstone did me the honour of inviting me to crack a bottle of claret at the Sheridan Club, and as he had given me my first and my last Chancery will, I did him the honour of accepting. As we sat in a quiet room, under the portraits of old actors and even older judges, Featherstone said, "No reason why you shouldn't know, Rumpole. Your client had been Percy's mistress for years." "Miss Beasley? Matey? The old dragon of the nursing home, his mistress?" I was astonished. I let my amazement show. "His what?" "Girlfriend." Featherstone made it sound even more inappropriate. "It seems odd somehow calling a stout elderly woman a girlfriend. Are you trying to tell me Guthrie intimacy actually took place?"
"Regularly, apparently. On a Wednesday. Matron's afternoon off. But when Colonel Roderick Allard went into Sunnyside, she dived into bed with him and deserted Percy. The meeting at the tea-room was when the Colonel told his brother all about it and said he meant to leave his money to Rosemary Beasley."
I was silent. I drank claret. I began to wonder where the planchette came in.
"But why couldn't your client have told us that?" I asked my ex-opponent. "His wife, Rumpole. His wife, Marcia. She's a battle axe, and she was kept completely in the dark about Matey. It seems there would have been hell to pay if she'd found out, so we had to settle."
Well, Featherstone. Matron the femme fatale. I'd never have believed it. What did I believe? That the Colonel spoke from the grave? Or that Matron invented all the seances to tell us a truth which would have caused her deep embarrassment to communicate in any other way? As it was, she told me nothing. All I knew was that I didn't fancy the idea of the other side. I knew I shouldn't care for long chats with Colonel Allard and the Emperor Napoleon, even if Joseph Stalin were to be of the party. Dying, as far as I was concerned, had been postponed indefinitely.